myself is because I ran from my feelings. I ran from the very thing I am. If I am not my feelings, what am I? What am I? I'm certainly not this car.
I haven't spoken with very much, but I have heard his tape, and I think probably you've all said you can't top this. Well, you wait. We sat in the committee sometime, maybe it was March, sometime earlier in the year, and Phil, it's your, you did it to us, came running up to me and said, you've got to hear this speaker, he is amazing. So we sat in the committee meeting, we listened to it, and all the mouth, the jaws dropped open. Oh my God, he told my story. You're going to have to follow this, you know. He's not going to be funny at all. He's just going to make you cry. Anyway, I think probably at that point I said to myself, this man is saying something that I don't think I've ever heard in AA before. Maybe it's been said, but I didn't hear it. That's not your fault. That's probably mine. And I hope that you'll enjoy it. I'm really looking forward to hearing Bob myself. Bob?
Well, good morning, happy Sunday. I am Bob Earl. I am a drug addict and an alcoholic. Oh, it is easy. It's simple. It's not easy. That's right. I feel funny closing a convention. I haven't done that in a while because people usually want everybody to go home happy. And I'm not here to make you happy. I heard an Al-Anon speaker a while back in Vancouver who, as far as I'm concerned, summed up for me what I am about when I am asked to share at an AA conference or anywhere in AA. She said her sponsor had told her that her responsibility, her sole responsibility, was to disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed. I'm here to disturb the comfortable. So on the off chance you may not want to waste your morning, I'll tell you a little story to give you an idea of where I'm going, and you can decide if you want to stay or not. That includes Howard, who would really hope the phone call wouldn't come. But we all understand that. A while ago, let's get on with what I used to be like. I drank exactly the right amount of alcohol and used exactly the right amount of narcotics to get me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous at 26 years of age on August 28, 1962. I've been clean and sober ever since, and to save you a lot of mental energy, I'm 22 years clean and sober and 48 years old. About a year ago, I don't not remember when it was, a friend of mine, not on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, called me up and said, I have four house guests. I've been telling them about you. I've been telling them about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like you to come over and meet these people. I'd like them to meet you. They'd like to go to AA. So I said, okay, great. I have an insatiable curiosity anyway. I always like to look behind the door. It says employees only. Oh, I was never allowed that when I was a child. We'll get into that later. So I went over, and his house guests were four men, two psychiatrists from the state of New York, young guys, very bright, were degreed in more than one specialty of psychiatry. I mean, they spent a lot of time in school, these guys. Minds like being with a computer that was tuned into the emotions. They were incredible people to be around. With them, however, were too much more fascinating people. These two guys were travelers, or what is commonly referred to as travelers. They are people who at one point in their lives, someone said to them, God put all of this here for you. This planet is your backyard. It's your playground. It's for you to enjoy. Enjoy. Taking that literally, they had spent their lives doing just that, traveling, enjoying the whole world, every inch of it. Now, these guys were fascinating to me for a lot of reasons. One is the travelers were fascinating. The shrinks, they were intelligent, not necessarily fascinating. Right on. Kids know. The kid knows. We'll get to the kids soon. We'll talk about this kid soon. You'll leave here with someone this morning you may not have brought with you. Your own inner child. The travelers had never had a drink of alcohol, had never had a narcotic of any kind in their life, had never smoked pot. They had never drinking coffee. They had never tasted sugar. They had never eaten any meat of any kind. Fish, chicken, beef, pork. Didn't know what it tasted like, only knew what it looked like. They had been raised totally on spiritual principles and a vegetarian diet. They were in their 40s. They were not youngsters who had just begun this path. Being with them was fascinating. I think about it now, I get emotional. There was such a peace. It was like walking into the eye of a hurricane, almost. You know, where they say it, I don't know, I've never walked into one. It's an analogy from the mind, which has no idea, nothing about nothing and speaks on everything. It's like you walk up into their presence, and in their presence there's peace. And you look into their eyes and you know that they know, and there is no doubt in their mind that there is a God and all things are in perfect order, and they never question that. And they have spent their lives traveling, giving whatever they had to give, however small it might be, wherever it was needed, and receiving in return and knowing they would always receive in return what they needed. In this instance, they were with somebody who they had met, who they didn't know, who was housing them and feeding them. And they could accept that with great grace. They knew it was not him doing it, but it was God doing it through them. So, we chatted for a while, and I took these four guys to three meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I took them to a speaker meeting, I took them to a discussion meeting, and I took them to a participation meeting. Now, they agreed on one thing, that we had a disease that would kill us. Immediately they plugged into that whatever it is, whatever this alcoholism is, it is a terminal illness. It is an illness that will take your life. That they grasped right away. I won't waste time on why the psychiatrists thought we were sober. They had a lot of very intellectually bright perceptions as to why the 12 steps were in the order they were in, and anyhow. The travelers, on the other hand, knew that we were sober by grace. It was no issue to them. They knew that it was because of God that we were clean and sober, and for no other reason. For absolutely no other reason. But they looked at me, the travelers, and they said, and they were concerned. They said, these people who have been inflicted with this disease that will kill them, come to this Alcoholics Anonymous. And by grace, this disease is removed from them. And they said, but instead of then, from that point, reaching out for all of its life in its fullness, they sit there in those rooms and they continue to kill themselves. They smoke cigarettes by the carton, they drink coffee by the barrel, they eat sugar by the pound, nobody gets enough sleep. Everybody runs on a level of high anxiety, and no one breathes. Now, so that you will know where this talk is going, I agree. I absolutely agree. I agree with every perception they had about us, 100%. And I'm not an outsider. I've been here 22 years. You know, I ain't new to this joint. And I was a smoker. And a meat eater and a sugar eater and a lot of other things. I had to listen to Bob's talk this morning on tape because the smoke drove me out Friday night. And I enjoyed what he said about, I can't even remember what the hell it was he said. Well, we'll go on. I used to spend a lot of time talking about the voices. A lot of what he said in his talk was true about, you know, the, about year three, I'm convinced that you now know that you're crazier than you have ever been at any time in your life prior to 3 years of sobriety. I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One is I believe the feelings start to come back the third year. And I don't think the alcoholic, I know I didn't know how to handle feelings. I didn't know what feelings were. Of course, I also was labeled as psychotic social psychopath too, but I don't know if that contributed to my not knowing what feelings were or not. Yeah. Jesus. So I don't know. When I show up, I just show up, and I have to listen to my talk too, because I don't know, you know. And sometimes I like it, and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I'm totally stunned by it. Other times I like to hide, and other times I like to give somebody else blame for whatever the hell it is I'm saying. Let's get to how I know. Let's get to why I believe the travelers are right. The first year in Alcoholics Anonymous was like anybody else's first year in Alcoholics Anonymous. First 90 days to 6 months were spent in an absolute complete fog. The easiest part, I think, of sobriety for a great many of us who have come in off of rooftops and out of doorways and living in the streets is the first few months. Because you're so far gone. You know, I mean, I was sick. I was physically ill. I weighed 135 pounds. I weigh about 190 now, so you can imagine what I look like, you know, 50, 60 pounds later. My brains were gone, short-circuited. You know, I was into that marvelous rummy state where it was sort of just bop along, sitting in doorways. So these first few months were very quiet. You know, just kind of sit here. Yeah, okay. Be at this meeting. Yeah, okay. Don't talk to him. Oh, okay. That's a lousy fucking AA group. Don't go there. Oh, okay. Yeah, you just kind of go, you know, sit, move, be, you know, you don't care. You're not thinking. The brain hasn't kicked back into gear yet. You know, the circuits have not started to go back together, so you're okay. About 6-8 months, the circuits start to go back together. You start to get a little nuts, and then your sponsor gives you somebody to sponsor. So now you're trying to take care of some other guy with a fried brain. Tell him where to sit, where to go, who not to talk to, and where's there's a lousy meeting, you know. All of which are none of your ideas. You know, you just do it because you've been told. We're terribly pliable, the alcoholic. We don't think we are, but we really are. We are anybody with any shrewdness at all can use us like a puppet. Sober. Screw drinking. That's a breeze when we're drinking. We belong to the world when we're drinking. So I got to the end of my first year, and they gave me then they take you to an institutional committee, and they give you a lot of panels, and I took all my panels, and I went, and I hated them. And if you are new, if you're in your first year, first couple years, the only thing I would share out of mine that I learned that's critical is don't wait till you want to do these things. Don't sit around in AA until you want to take a panel, or until you want to make coffee, or until you want to mop a floor. Just go do it. The odds are, if you're from the places that many of us are from, you'll never want to do it. Waiting for right motives the first couple of years could cost you your life. Just do it. You know, just. I don't even want to get into right motives. Anyhow, one problem I had, we'll give certainly God all the time he deserves on Sunday. Maybe we throw a quick prayer in for the Raiders, too. I'm just here, you know. I guess that speaker should be more reserved. I won't be. Don't worry about it. Just because I say that doesn't mean I will be. The first couple of years, I had a small problem with God. The problem was this. People in AA kept saying, God as you understand him.
Use the doorknob if you need to, son. The ocean is fine. Goddamn pier, whatever you want. Your automobile must find a higher power greater than yourself. God, as you understand them, it'll be okay.
Now, you've got mental patients, for Christ's sake. You can't talk to mental patients like that, you know. I mean, we need a little more guidance than that. That's, you know. My first higher power was blonde, 5'11". I said, oh, yeah, well, you know. And it's not because you don't want God that you don't pray. It's if you're like I am, it's because you're afraid of him. Because they kept saying, as you understand him. I have no formal religious training of any kind. I'm not Irish Catholic or anything else, right? I just kind of came out of a WASP family, an alcoholic family, traditional alcoholic family. Traditional alcoholic father, right, who never wanted any children, and the mother who stood around and smiled quietly and watched the goddamn family be destroyed around her while she pretended everything was okay. I have no respect for people who do that. None. Zero. I think children should be taken away and rescued. My opinion, right? I told you may not want to stay for this talk. Anyhow, let us get to the Al-Anons. Good morning. I haven't been asked to talk at an Al-Anon gathering in years. I can't understand that. There's an organization around AA now. It's not around AA. It's on our fringes. It's called ACA. It's the Adult Children of Alcoholics. And there's a wonderful issue going on with it. It's about 6 to 8 years old. And the thing about it that's really humorous to me is that nobody wants it. Al-Anon doesn't want a goddamn thing to do with it, right? And AA doesn't want anything to do with it. And people are upset by that. And I can't understand why anybody is upset that the alcoholic and the Al-Anon don't want the kid. They never did. You know, why the hell should they want them now? And I'm a parent, you know, so if you're parent, I may make you very uncomfortable this morning. Understand, I know that. Okay? Huh? You may leave here with acid indigestion. Be aware that I know that. I'm not up here oblivious to what I'm saying. I understand the discomfort of what I'm saying can cause. I understand the pain of some of the things I'm going to talk about can cause. But I said when I opened this sucker, I'm here to disturb the comfortable. Because being comfortable in AA, 17 years sober, I almost died. I almost died. And I watch a lot of people die. Okay? So I'm not here to make you feel good or make you laugh or have a good time. I'm here to talk about what I believe in based on my experience. And I think we have a tendency sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous to perpetrate the disease. Because I'm convinced you can, by my experience over 22 years, you can get more support for failure in AA than you can success. Something's wrong when we do that. Something's wrong when we do that. You watch a guy walk into his home group. Everybody's known him for 10 years. And he's ever just been kind of an average guy. Never a big deal in AA, never a big deal outside of AA. Just showed up, drank his coffee, shared now and then. Let him come bopping into his home group and say, just sit there, you know, it's a discussion meeting, he's waiting for his turn, and he's just bouncing in his chair because he can't stand it. He wants to share so bad. And finally they get to him, and he jumps up and he says, oh, God, let me tell you what happened to me. I just signed a brand new contract with a brand new company. They gave me $250,000 for signing. I'm going to make $750,000 a year. They gave me a Rolls Royce to drive. It's goddamn wonderful. Let's see who takes him to coffee after the meeting. You know. Let's see how many people come up and talk to him who don't want something from him. Now, conversely, let him come back to the meeting a year from now and say, oh, Jesus. Company suffered some reversal, and they lost their ass, and I lost mine, and it's over. There'll be 50 people to take them to coffee.
Did you really lose it all? Everything? Even the car? Did you lose the rolls?
Well, why the hell do we do that? I mean, we're not bad people. We really aren't bad people. But we do that. That's a reality. And why? It's simple. Because we think he got ours. That's why. I think he got my success. The son of a bitch got mine. That was my contract. That was my $250,000. That was my Rolls Royce. He's got mine. I'm finished. I'll never get mine. Why do we think that way? Well, we think that way because I'm convinced that the single basic ingredient in alcoholism and in thwarted recovery is no self-esteem. I heard Bob's definition of the alcoholic, the two guys sitting in the room, and the one guy who goes out and gets hit in the head with a baseball bat and comes back and goes out again and again and again. And that's an alcoholic. That's not an alcoholic. That's a person with no self-esteem. I know people who don't drink who will do the same thing because they think of themselves as worthless. And people who think of themselves as worthless will keep going out the door and getting hit in the head because they believe that's what they deserve. And they learned that when they were very small. They learned their original value from the original dynamic duo. <You know>? See, we... those who can keep up. I know I left off at one point, man, I'm somewhere else, but... Those of you who are on the wavelength will stay with me. Those of you who aren't, God bless you, may have an easier sobriety. You walk in there. What the hell kind of? I'll try and tell it in order. I don't know why. There are four of us up here giving this talk. It's difficult. Well, you have four voices in one mouth. They always sort of jam up. You know? Used to be 13, so I consider that's mental health. I mean, this is peaceful and controllable. You know, it used to be like, what do you want to do? God, I don't know, you know. Jesus, I threw my neck out. That's what happens when you're schizophrenic. Who's schizophrenic? I'm not schizophrenic. Let the neck settle down. All right, I'll try and tell it in order. Also, being afraid of God is a sign of no self-esteem, feeling unworthy. See, I never figured God would work for me because I believed I was one of the bad guys, and God does not work for the bad guys. He just doesn't. Any idiot knows that. You know, anything you read will tell you that. Watch a little late-night Christian television, and you'll learn. You know, you got to be one of the good guys. And I believe, by the way, so I heard a lot of talk about, I've known Angie forever, and everybody, and I've heard a lot of talk about good and well, and God bless everybody, but I believe good and well are synonymous. I believe they go together like that. What I do think happens, however, is that our conception of good changes. I believe that's what happens. I don't think we don't cease to be good that you can get well without, never mind. That's too goddamn intellectual. Where did that come from? The mind loves it, you know. For those of you who don't know, there's only one enemy that you are going to have to do battle with the entire time you are sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that enemy is lodged between your ears. It is your mind. No one will do to you what your mind will do to you. No one will say to you what your mind will say to you. No one would stay awake all night long figuring out how to wipe you out but you. No one hates you that bad. Just you. Your mind will be there to be supporting. Never mind. I'll get to that. Any new adventure you intend to take on. Listen, now we don't want to do that. You'll fail. Don't bother. I admire Bob. At least he starts. I didn't pray to God because I was one of the bad guys. God wouldn't work for the bad guys. I used to listen to people at AA meetings and God worked for them, and I wanted that God so desperately I couldn't stand it. I wanted him so bad.
I listened to some guy at an AA meeting. He said, oh, geez, I got up this morning, walked out in the kitchen, and instead of my breakfast cereal, there were divorce papers in my place on the table. I don't know what to do. She threw me the hell out of the house. I went to work. I got to work. They laid me off at work. I went out to get my car. My car had been repossessed because the payments were behind, and I didn't know. So I went back into the building where I worked, got in, went into the men's room, got on my knees, looked at the ceiling in the men's room and said, oh, God, I can't figure it out. Please, you got to take it. I don't know what to do. And I'm here tonight at the meeting to report to you. My wife changed her mind. I'm back home. They got a new contract at work, and I'm reemployed, and there was an error in the bookkeeping, and they returned my car. Well, who doesn't need that kind of help? You know what I'm saying? I'm sitting there, you're probably a year and a half sober, with my shoulder blades pinned together from tension and my neck over to one side, ready to drop dead, you know, just from minor stress in my daily sober life. I would like to pray, you understand, but nobody's going to goddamn listen, so why bother, you know, which only increases the tension. I should check the stress level of people sober in AA if they want to talk about stress. God. I mean, we wake up with stress. I mean, stress is like the mornings. I don't know about any of you, but I mean, most of the people I know anyway, the mind is the enemy. And upon awakening, the mind is there waiting for you. Have you noticed? The mind just kind of sits on the headboard all night like a vulture. You know? Looks down at you and waits. You wake up first thing in the morning, your head says to you, see, it thinks it's separate from you. The dumb son of a bitch doesn't know it's attached. It literally thinks it can shoot itself and it won't die, you know. So it sits on the headboard, you wake up, it looks down, the first thing it says, oh, good, I'm glad you're awake. Huh? I want to talk to you for a minute. Now, if you listen, your day is over. See, because the first thing it's going to tell you is that you're going to have sleep. Doesn't matter how much sleep you had, you haven't had enough. See? That's going to say to you, well, you better not go to work today as tired as you are. Then I'll say, well, you're going to have to go to work, because if you don't go to work, they're going to fire you. But then again, as tired as you are, you're probably going to screw up, and they're going to fire you anyway. So now that you're out of work, what are we going to do? You don't have a lot of money, you know. You got maybe enough for 6 weeks. We might be able to just eke out 6 weeks here, and that's it. It's over, you know. So, you know, it's 6 weeks are up, and we're broke, you know, and... You're out of work and you're broke. What the hell are you going to do? Oh, stop rubbing your knee. You know that bump on your knee is bone cancer. Why are you concerned with it? Ben says, I want to know how you're going to handle the bone cancer. You're going to go to meetings and talk about it, or you're just going to be chicken shit, stay home and rot to death? You know. Well, you've been awake for about a total of 7 seconds. You're unemployed, broke, and dying. Other than that, it'll probably be a pretty good day. People wonder why the hell we don't leap out of bed to greet the morning, you know. You ever see a lot of alcoholics? Nobody jumps up. You know, nobody leaps up and says, hey, another beautiful day. We should be doing that, but we don't. Because we listen to this sucker. See, and it doesn't know anything. That's the interesting thing about it. It doesn't really know anything. Anyhow, onward quickly. Here. 2 years clean and sober, I'm sitting in a meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, and a guy tells a story. And I've been told that he didn't tell this story, but I heard the story, so I don't care. Sometimes voices come from other places than here, and it's okay. If it comes from here, it's all right. If it comes from here, you're in a lot of trouble. never mind. We'll get to that. No, I might as well say it while it's on my mind. I'll forget it. Everybody talks about God's will. How do you tell God's will? How do you know what God's will is? I can't tell what God's will is. I believe it's the simplest thing in the world. Simplest thing in the world. Just start moving. Pick a direction and take off, man. go out the door and start moving. And if you hit a wall, turn left. That's it. It's that complicated. See? But the alcoholic, we don't turn left at the wall. Because we're scared, and we don't like the unknown, and we like the familiar. Even if the familiar is crap, we like the familiar. And we hit the wall, and because we don't have a whole lot of self-esteem, we stay at the wall. Hmm? Well, it's not bad here, you know. It's not exactly what I had in mind, but there's not a whole hell of a lot of destruction here. Or if we don't stay at the wall, we get back and we run at it and run into it until we knock it over. And then we're sitting on the other side of the wall and all this rubble, and what we have done is we have forced our way into what we want, and it's not what we want. So we sit in this pile and say, Jesus, this isn't it. And the secret is turning left at the wall. And if you turn left, you'll be fine. But turning left takes trust. Turning left takes a little self-esteem. Turning left takes believing that God will take care of you if you turn left. But we think so much. We get into the mind instead of into the feeling, because we're afraid of the feeling. We're afraid of the feelings because I am absolutely, totally, thoroughly convinced I am my feeling. That's who I am. We walk around here very lonely and very alone because we can't find ourselves. And a reason we can't find ourselves, and a reason I couldn't find myself, is because I ran from my feelings. I ran from the very thing I am. If I am not my feelings, what am I? What am I? I'm not my personality, you know, we're all multiple personalities here. Be what the situation requires. So I can't be that. You know, can't be where I live. It can be wiped out with a fire or a flood or a, you know, whatever, earthquake. Gone, that quick. What does that leave? You know, I'm not the bones. They can be changed and altered and worked on and scoot around with. What is it? It's feelings. I am my feeling. But I'm scared to death of my feelings. Because as a child, I was never allowed to feel anything. I was never allowed to express feeling. Children who grow up in the household of alcoholics cannot express feelings. You are allowed one thing, silence. And you learn to be a little actor. You learn to be whatever the situation requires in order to keep peace. God talked about not fitting in, that thing about going to a party or a gathering. I mean, that is the typical thing of, like, you grow up in an alcoholic household, you don't have an identity. You don't have one. And so any gathering you go to, you gotta stand in the corner and watch the people. Until you figure out what they're doing so you can move into the room and join them. That's tragic. That's absolutely tragic. And we do it sober. Every new business meeting, every new job, every new company, every new group of people we meet, everywhere we go. If you're the adult child out of an alcoholic household, you will not just walk into a room full of strangers and be comfortable and sit down and say, "Hi, I'm Bob. How are you?" And know that Bob is enough. Know that Bob is enough. Know that you don't have to say anything, do anything, sing, dance, or wear any special kind of clothes. Just sit down and know that Bob is enough. See, I never knew I was enough. I always thought something's wrong with me. What's wrong with me? I'm on track again, but I'm going to stay on this one for a minute. In the beginning in AA, when I first come in, we have a lot of cliches in AA, and we just whip them around meeting rooms like frisbees. You know, none of these cliches are in the book. They're all just answers that have come up out of I don't know where, and we use them. And one of them is interesting. I can remember sitting in a meeting one time, and I mumbled to somebody. I said, You know, my old man was a drunk, and Jesus Christ, I mean, it was, my household was just, I mean, I really am that son of a bitch. And this guy looked at me, well-meaning, he said, hey, son, you must forgive your parents. They did the very best job they could do with the tools they had. So you sit there, and you go,
yeah, okay,
right? I mean, intellectually, that's highly acceptable. Intellectually, that's very acceptable. That is a logical statement. Anything that's logical to me is dangerous to me, too. But that's a logical statement. So you say, oh, okay, great, cool, I got it. Did the best they could. Now, a few months later, Christmas rolls around. Right? And you go down to visit the family for Christmas. 13 miles from the house, you start to get uncomfortable. You don't know why. Figure something's wrong with you. It's got to be me. All right? They did the best they could. I forgive them. I'm walking in forgiveness. Yeah. I don't feel good. Closer to the house you get, the more uncomfortable you get. You walk in with the presents that you bought you cannot afford. You're going to get their goddamn love somehow. You'll buy it one way or the other. I'll get their attention and their love if it kills me. Almost killed a lot of us. You sit down. Nobody's changed since you went away and got sober. Everybody's the same. Conversation's the same. Nothing's new. Same bullshit wall to wall in the house, right? You sit there. Your throat starts to close. Mine did, anyway. My throat would start to get tight. Because I was not saying things that I wanted to say. I didn't know what they were, because they weren't from the mind. They were from in here. There was a little child in here who wanted to scream, and I'm closing my throat off to keep this child from screaming. Then the stomach starts to get upset. And you start looking for Rolaids somewhere, anywhere, a little relief for the stomach. And everybody else is happy. You're the one poor distressed bastard in the room, right? It's like, you know, I'm in forgiveness. You know? They did the best they could. And then suddenly, about maybe 12 minutes into this Christmas encounter with the family, all I can think about now is getting a flamethrower and torching the whole goddamn family. You know, I'm just sitting there thinking, it'll be over in a minute. Just... But now I've been in AA, you can't think that. See? So now the AA voice comes in and says, oh, you son of a bitch, jeez, what's wrong with you? You are really sick to be thinking those kind of thoughts. You better take more steps, write more inventories, help more new people, go to more meetings, because you're something wrong with you thinking that stuff about those people. So you make up a lie about a newcomer you got to go help, and you leave so you don't have to die sober in the living room just sitting there. From all this internal inner energy while you're in forgiveness. I forgive. You know, there's a time and a place for forgiveness. I'm convinced through my own pain and sobriety, you can't forgive until you know what the hell it is you're forgiving. You know, because there are emotions involved here that involve in forgiveness. There's something going on down inside of here involved. And until you get in touch with this in here, you're making an intellectual exercise. And you will still never be comfortable, you'll still never understand what's going on, and you'll still think you're wrong. You'll still think there's something wrong with you. I'm delighted to report there's nothing wrong with any of us. Absolutely nothing wrong with any of us. I'll get to that. Back to the meeting. What time is this meeting over?
When you get done.
Don't say that. Because my plane isn't until 5. Okay, 2 years sober, sitting in AA meeting, a guy, I hear this story. Two men drinking in a bar in Alaska. One is an atheist, the other is a very religious man. Eventually, their conversation swings around to God. Atheist looks at the religious man and says, I don't believe in God. The religious man says, why not? Atheist said, I gave your God a chance to prove himself to me once and he didn't do it. Religious man says, in what manner did you give God a chance to prove himself? Atheist says, well, 6 months ago I was lost 150 miles north of town in a blizzard. I knelt down in the snow. I looked at the sky. I said, God, if there is one, I'm lost and I'm going to die. Religious man looks at him, smiles a very knowing smile. Says, why, you must believe you're here. Atheist said, nah, some goddamn Eskimo came along and showed me the way back to town. Well, I heard that story and I lit up like a Christmas tree. Because I had one sponsor who was an absolute maniac, who had a voice who would fill a 1,000-seat auditorium without a microphone, right? Roared, a massive, angry man, a cop killer, just an insane lunatic. Well, that's why they gave me to him, of course, too. We got along well, he and I. And he would only talk softly when he would sit me down and he'd say, Bob, you've got to understand, God is inside of you. He is inside of you. He's not out there. He's inside. The kingdom of heaven is within. And like all of us, well, not like all of us, I always treated my sponsors equally. I agreed with everything they said, even though I didn't agree with anything they were saying. I would sit there and go, I got it, I understand. My mind is saying, don't be ridiculous. I am bad and God is good. Now, if I'm bad, God's good. God can't be, something good can't be inside something bad. And I'd walk away. But now I've heard the story about the Eskimos, and I remember how I got to AA. See, because Eskimos got me to AA. All right? I never called this joint. All right? I never picked up the phone. I couldn't pick up the phone. I had the phone number and I had a dime that I hid from myself. And I'd come out of my doorway on a lot of occasions that I was living in, and I would go to a phone booth, take the dime, drop it in, dial the number, hang up, and walk away because I am of that need to look good. Terminally cool, you know? I will die. I will goddamn die before I will look bad or needy. All right? Wonderful what we do to ourselves. Is that smart? Hey, I'm cool. Kill me. I don't care. That is, well, never mind. Anyway, after trying this 50 times, one day I'm sitting in my doorway and an Eskimo walks up. I hear this voice over me say, hey, if you don't have any place to stay, you can come stay with me and the old lady. And I look up and here's a guy that owes me a fortune, right? I mean, him and his old lady and 6 kids had been on welfare ever since I'd known him. All right, he was into me for $5,000 or $6,000, right? So I'm okay now. See, he's got to take me out of the doorway, man. He's got to take me home. It is his responsibility. It's his goddamn duty. It's the code of the streets. He's got to take me home. There's no charity here. He owes it to me. God understood my insanity perfectly. So I said, yeah, all right, great, man. So I bop home with this sucker to his one-bedroom apartment a block from where I live. Him, his old lady, the 6 kids are stuck in a one-bedroom apartment. Wall-to-wall cockroaches. And I'm sitting there that night on the floor talking to him on the couch, and I'm shaking, and I said, one of these days I've got to call that AA man and go do something about my drinking. He said, there's a girl down the hall goes to AA. Oh, I thought, this is not, remember, this is 1962, right? I thought, wow, I mean, I didn't even know girls went to AA. The only AA meetings I'd ever seen had been in institutions, and the people went because the parole board said you had to go, or they were, you know, crippled winos who drugged themselves into the meeting, you know. And I've never had a conception of a woman who went to AA. So I went down the hall to see what the hell a woman who goes to AA looks like. You know, I had an envision, you know. I expected Gravel Gertie to open the door, you know. I had no idea what the hell a woman looked like. Well, I knock on the door, and this girl opens the door. Well, God again knew me, okay? And he knew that if this had been some stone fox on the other side of the door, I would have lied. All right? Now, I was in the only clothes I'd been living in for months, all right? But I still would have stood, I mean, I would have started that quick because the mind is just starts talking without really giving any
conscious effort to what it's saying. I would have begun some bullshit speech about, listen, I understand you're involved in an organization that deals with alcoholism. I have a father who's inflicted with the disease of alcoholism. Perhaps you can dispense some information that would aid me in assisting this poor bastard, you know. God knew that. The girl that opened this door is big enough to break every bone in my body. 35 pounds. She was built like a pro football fullback. She had short black hair. She had tattoos all the way down both arms and both legs. And she was drinking a half pint of booze. A pint of booze. It was half full. This is my introduction to AA. Okay? I've been clean and sober ever since, and we walk around these goddamn AA meetings cautious of what we say to the newcomer. That is the biggest joke I've ever heard in my life. Where do we think they're coming from, for Christ's sake? Treatment? I'm a support of it, by the way. I mean, it doesn't sound like I am, but I am. Even if the recovery rate is low, I have a lot of respect for
it. Well, it is. It is. I don't say that maliciously. The reality is it is. It's less than 20%. I mean, because it's intervention. Intervention does never work well. We must understand that. Don't expect from it something it can't give you. The intervention does not work well. It never has, never will. I mean, it's no different than in the beginning when they used to walk in bars and drag guys off the bar stool and take them to the meeting and say, we're going to get you sober. Guys stay sober a little while. I say, well, this isn't my idea. What the hell am I doing here? You know, I'll see you later. And they leave. The 20% to stay, I think, work a better program than most of us. That's why I like treatment. I think they're more in touch with their feelings, and they've been jammed to deal with things that we don't make new people deal with here. And I'm not too sure we should. Anyhow, this girl looked at me and I said, I'm curious about AA. I could talk to her. She's street people. I'm comfortable with street people. And she looks me right in the eye with this booze. AA will work if you want it, and I am not ready to quit drinking. It made perfect sense to me. I mean, it was fine by me. It was logical to me because I thought, God, you know, if I was a big tough broad, I wouldn't quit either. You know. But I was 135 pounds, almost dead. I looked like a fugitive from a concentration camp. I was just standing there. It was over. I hadn't used any drugs in 6 months. The brains were fried. I was considering prison as a place to go be, you know. Just break a window of a liquor store, sit in the window and drink some booze and wait till they come and got me. I mean, that's where I was at. That was it. All the bullshit was over. The guns were gone. The shootouts with the police departments were over. All the chaining, beatings, cuffings, all that shit was over. All the bad guy stuff was gone. I was just... brains were gone. You know? So, if I looked like her, I would have been out there still. Well... she was badder than most guys I knew. You know? She stuck me in a car, took me to an AA meeting. She felt a responsibility for the sobriety she had. Okay, so that's 22 years ago. I've been clean and sober ever since. Well, now I'm back to 2 years. I've heard this story, and I think Eskimos took me to AA, and I leave that meeting, and I feel like $1 million, like $1 million. Man, I go bopping home to my house, and I'm just so goddamn excited, I can't stand it. It's like, oh, yeah, yahoo, wow, man, God works through people. If he's in me, he's in everybody, and he works through people, and I'm like, it's okay.
Finally, God.
Look, I go home, slide into the house, sit down in my chair. Big mistake.
There was a shrink one time who said that the armchair is the neurotic spaceship. Where we sit and think and we leave this plane. I sit down. I'm excited. I found God. It's okay. It's about time. 2 years of miserable goddamn sobriety. It's about time. And the mind says to me, okay, God may be keeping you clean and sober, but there are three areas of your life he is not interested in. I go, well, yeah? What are they? Now, I've learned not to say things like that to my mind anymore. Most of the time today, to the best of my ability, I usually only ask my mind one question.
What is your source of information?
Because it never has one, you know? I mean, it reads the Little Reader's Digest, a little Time magazine, watches a little TV, and thinks it's a goddamn nuclear physicist, you know? It will comment on anything, anything. It doesn't have to have any information. You know, it'll discuss anything. Doesn't care if it embarrasses me to death. It just starts talking. You know. But unfortunately, on this day, I said, oh, really? What are the areas that God isn't interested in? Well, my mind says the first area God isn't interested in is money. Thought about that for a minute. Made sense. Once again, it was logical to me. Any idiot knows that God and money are not synonymous. I had watched enough late-night Christian television to know that poverty and God are synonymous, and that if you've got any left over, you should send it in. So I could accept that. Now remember, I was a lunatic 2 years clean and sober, sitting here weighing all this stuff, okay? I said, what else? It says employment. God does not care where you work. That's logical, isn't it? And we've got a whole planet here. We've got people starving here. We've got wars going on. I mean, there's big things happening. What the hell does God care where I work? Where I punch a clock should not be as significant to God. So, yeah, okay, I accept that. What else? I say to my mind, women. God is not interested in relationships. Thought about that for a minute. The word sin came up. I had read page 69 of the big book and interpreted to say, as long as you don't intentionally harm any of your sisters, have a good time. So I figured, yeah, it's best to keep him out of that area. You know, it's made sense. I thought I'd have, you know, be able to sleep better at night. Well, okay, now I know God's keeping me clean and sober. He doesn't care about money, where I work, or relationship. I spent the next 2 years of my sobriety, from year two to year four, armed with just that information. God's keeping me clean and sober. I've got to deal with money, women, and employment. Interesting thing my mind has done to me here. Very interesting thing. You all know when you come into AA, people usually give you people to sponsor who are of the same mental alertness of yourself. So, I got all the maniacs, right? They would give me guys who had just gotten out after doing 33 years in death row for blowing up a building with 112 people in it because they didn't have anything to do Sunday afternoon and were bored, right? A couple of members of the family are in the building. They didn't give a shit about that either. It's just they needed something to do, right? So I got these guys who were raving goddamn maniacs, right? Guys who spent their life bench pressing 500 pounds and three inmates just for something to do, you know. Now, none of these people ever call for help in the middle of the night. Ever. I never call for help in the middle of the night. They don't call for help in the middle of the night. I mean, that would be admitting weakness and need. And they, again, are of the same mentality, which is look good or die. But on the rare occasion one of them would call, the pain would be so great that they would have drugged themselves by their fingernails across the carpet in their house, pulled the phone to the floor, dialed, got me on the phone at 3 a.m. in the morning, and just begun screaming in the phone. The source of their pain was always one of three things: money, employment, or women. Now, these were the three areas my mind had just told me I should handle. Well, I did. I handled them. And approaching my fourth birthday in AA, good AA member, you know, went to meetings, sponsored, went to institutions, talked, never said no to an AA request. And at 4 years clean and sober, I was going bankrupt through the courts. I'd been handling the money.
The car was going into bankruptcy. Didn't have a car. I was working in a car wash for $1.25 an hour. I was handling the employment. I had started at $1.35. I was the only one in the car wash spoke English. Okay? I hadn't been with a girl in so long that I couldn't even get anybody to go to coffee with me. You know, after a while, guys, they can see you coming all the way across the meeting hall. You may say you want to go talk about the third step, but they can just see it, you know. Hi. Want to go have a little coffee and talk about God? You know. Quite correctly, they back up from the plane, most of them. If they don't, you wish the hell they had, you know. And to top all that off, many of you who spent a lot of time in institutions, you know we always spend a lot of time sitting on concrete. People who spend a lot of time sitting on concrete wind up with hemorrhoids, right? So now from bouncing in and out off of these hot car seats all day long in a goddamn car wash, my hemorrhoids were coming back. So this is how I was approaching my fourth birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous. Bankrupt, no automobile, sleeping on the couch of a guy I didn't even particularly like in his apartment because I had no place to live, working in a car wash for $1.25 an hour, my hemorrhoids were coming back, and I hadn't been laid in so long my eyes were crossed, right? Central office would call me with 12-step calls, and I had to call the guy and make sure two things. A, first he had a car. B, that he was sober so he could drive the car, pick me up so I could take him to the meeting. Right? Humiliation to death. I had done what my mind had told me. Anyhow, to make all this short... An Eskimo drove through the car wash and offered me another job at 50 cents an hour more, two blocks away, so I could still walk to work. So that was great. That was fine. And I took it and I worked on it for a year. And I learned some things when I was on that job. I learned I had to pay everybody I owed money weekly, or I couldn't pay them at all. I just wasn't capable of having it there at the end of the month. So I had to go face everybody, the district attorney on back child support, the phone company, the landlord, the electric company. I had to tell everybody, you take it weekly or you're running a big risk of not getting it at all. And they went with that. So I learned that. I learned how to get along with people at work because one day I went after a guy in the plant. And when I caught him, and I had a piece of pipe in my hand, and I really wanted to hurt him. And I looked in his face and I died. I just died. I just said, God, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to be this way anymore. I don't want to. Just, I was just so sick of anger, of rage. And I went and talked to a friend, and she said, actually, when I talked with Elsa. People should know, I always would talk to Elsa. I love Chuck, but Elsa gives better answers. Well, it just takes a long time. You know, when I'm dying, I love him, but I don't have time to listen to the goddamn deer in the canyon belong to him when I'm hanging out to dry. I need an immediate answer. So I said to Elsa, da-da-da-da-da, this is my problem at work, and she looked at me and said, well, then why don't you go to work for God instead of man? I said, what do you mean by going to work for God instead of man? She said, quite simply, what would God expect of you? He would expect you to show up on time, treat everyone like you would like to be treated, and expect nothing in return for your efforts, not even a paycheck. I wished I had talked to Chuck. So I went back to work and I learned how to do those things. About a month away from my fifth birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous, 2 months away from my fifth birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted to die. I came home from work one day and I sat down on my bed and I wanted to die. And for those of you who have been in this kind of depression, you'll understand what I'm saying sounds like a joke, but it's really not. The thought of suicide would have been a step up in the depression. Just if I could have raised myself to where I was willing to take my own life, it would have been a step up in the depression. I just wanted to sit there on this bed in this apartment and die.
I did not want to go on one more day. Now, there were thousands of people who would have told you that Bob E. was a good AA and a good institutional worker and a great sponsor and a great this and a great that and a wonderful, because I was being supported in the disease, not in the recovery, right? So I'm sitting there and I want to die. So I looked at, one of the things that troubled me about God was always praying, because I always thought you had to have special words. Huh? Special words. If you knew the right metaphysical terminology, God would help you. So out of this despair, out of this complete despair on my bed that night in my apartment, I looked at the ceiling and I screamed at the top of my lungs, because this is how I felt. I just got back and I just said, "If you're not there, I'm fucked!" And I waited, you know. I'm sure that bothers you, some of you, and I'm so sorry that your mind is so small that it lets words interfere with feelings. Because that's the truth about it. It's such a joke when people get upset about that kind of stuff. I just watch people. You know what he said? My best close personal friend gave a talk one night in Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lady came up to him afterwards with a piece of paper and showed him how many times he had sworn. God bless you. May someday you get out of your mind and into your heart and listen to people feel instead of listening to what they were word. Listen to the feeling. The word is unimportant. The feeling is critical. We force people to stuff feelings here. That's wrong. We do a thing at a lot of meetings in Southern California that is tragic, absolutely tragic. Someone will get up at a podium and they'll say, "God, I feel so bad today. My car was started. I got to work late, and then people make fun of me in my car." And people will sit there in a meeting and go, "Oh, you know." They did that to me once. I would watch an afternoon school special on TV one day, and it was about a little boy and his best friend. It was a little hour. So, and I watched this whole hour show, and it was over. I was very sad, because I realized I had never, ever had a best friend in my life. I had never had. You can't have best friends when you grow up in an alcoholic household. You can't bring anybody home. You know, it's a war zone, for Christ's sake. You can't bring them. You bring the neighborhood kids in to watch daddy throw straight up in the air. You can't do it. You know, you can't do it. So you're ashamed, embarrassed, humiliated, so you don't bring anybody home. So I go to this meeting and I say, "God, I watched this show and I thought, I never had a best friend." And these people went, "Oh," I went nuts, of course, you know. My sickness is that I don't know how to express my feelings, and when I have them, I think they're wrong. See? Because I'm so out of touch with me, I don't understand. So don't make me stuff my feelings. That's the worst thing you can do. And if I have to express my feelings in four-letter words, goddammit, let me express them. What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? Your feelings? Of course you are. When I reach to my pain, I'm going to get yours. I'm going to get yours. When I go back and I talk about my anguish, I'm going to get your anguish. Maybe. Maybe not. Anyhow, I went to work the next day after the surrender. Place a brand new machined Allen head wrench into a brand new machined Allen head bolt. They had been made for each other. Everyone knows that they can't slip. It did. I went backwards against one of the furnaces, crushed two vertebrae in my back, and I was taken to the emergency hospital. In the emergency hospital, doctors are saying, "Okay, you can't stand for long periods of time. You can't lift heavy things. Find another line of work.
take it easy, because my back is a disaster. I mean, when you are totally insane and you're on the streets, people come at you from back here. They don't come at you from up here. So my back has paid the price. I have a pelvis that's been snapped in half, fused vertebrae. It's just a myth. Anyhow, the doctors all leave this cubicle, and I'm laying there, and my mind says to me, huh? Always here to be a friend. Says, well, see, you dumb son of a bitch. I told you, you surrendered to God last night, and today he got you. He broke your back. It's what you had coming. Well, the child who lives down in here screamed at my mind and said, why don't you shut up? And I thought, boy, yeah, I am tired, you know? I'm just so tired of listening to that sucker. I think I will just not listen for a while. So I went about doing the things that were put in front of me to do. Filed for vocational rehabilitation, applied for disability insurance, went and got all my braces and supports for my back, and I just decided that maybe breaking my back was a good deal. That I have no way of knowing. See, I'm very quick to make judgments. This is good, that's bad.
Oh, that'll keep you in the closet for years. Jesus.
Yeah.
You can't get out of the house when you're busy. Ah, that's good, that's bad, that's good, that's bad. You know, it's hard to just get to the door, you know, much less get out the door.
Oh, I like that tie, I don't like that tie. Change the shirt. No, change the pants. Fix it. Oh, that's not right, you know. I mean,
you can't get away from the closet, you know.
So I just decided, hey, breaking my back was a good deal, right? I went to Voc Rehab. We had a lot of fun, Voc Rehab. 5 weeks, I took five aptitude tests, came out five different things. That's what I mean when I say we're not our personality. And I wasn't being cute. Honest to God, I swear to God, I was not being cute. I wasn't being clever. I wasn't playing bullshit paper games, you know, like you play when you're going through the institutions. None of that. I was honestly answering the questions as to how I felt that day. And I just came up different people. You know? Came up a forest ranger one day, outdoors. I hate the outdoors. Again. Man, the minute the asphalt neon disappear, I get nervous, you know. It's like... Crickets don't excite me. They make me, you know. I just raised in the street. I came out like a mechanically inclined. Give me a choice. I'll call a plumber to change the washer, man. You know, because I can. Used to be able, anyway, take it all apart. No, I'm better. Anyhow, I came out all these different things. 6 months went by. December rolled around. They couldn't place me. They could not place me. They didn't know what the hell to do with me. The only thing they wanted to do with me, I didn't want to do. You know, they said, we'll send you to UCLA. We'll get your high school equivalency test, send you to UCLA, and you can get a work hard, get a bachelor's in psychology, and you can go to work in the field of alcoholism. And I said, wait a minute. I mean, you're truly out of high school, right? For severe attitude problems. And you're going to put me on a university campus, huh? 27 years old, 5 years clean and sober, you're going to stick me out there with all them college boys and those co-eds. You're crazy. You know, you're out of your goddamn mind. Somebody's going to kill somebody if I don't wind up killing me, you know, just out of a sense of inadequacy. So we go through 6 months of this crap. One night I'm sitting there, I'm reading TV Guide, and I see an ad, and TV Guide says, how would you like to be a writer? A little voice down here inside of me says, yeah, great. Let's try that. I go, oh, the mind says, come on, you can't be a writer. And I thought, hey, I'm going to do what's put in front of me to do. Go trucking into Voc Rehab, take the ad from TV Guide, give it to my counselor. I say, here, this is what I'd like to do. I'd like to try this course. Being supportive, she laughed so hard she almost fell out of her wheelchair. Well, she had all my paperwork. She knew. You know, she knew I had failed English ever since the fourth grade. She knew I was thrown out of high school in the 10th grade. She knew I was a phonetic speller. You know, she had the great paperwork. It doesn't take an idiot to figure out he can't spell, you know. She thought it was hysterical, but God in his infinite wisdom had been very smart.
Very smart. She took it into her boss, the head of the Van Nuys office of Voc Rehab. Well, I was the one black mark of the Van Nuys office, the Voc Rehab. I had been on their rolls for 6 months. They had placed everybody from October, much less July, right? So he would have signed for basket weaving for me. He didn't care, you know. He was delighted.
He said, get him the books. Pay for the course.
So I get my books. I sit home. I start to read my books. I try and write a short story.
Huh?
It was awful. I want to tell you, it was very bad. I'm reading my books, and the books say, write for a medium that you're familiar with when you're a new writer. It's critical. I thought, oh, okay, well, I never read anything, so I got to give up writing a short story. But I watched a lot of television. Let's write for television. So I start writing a bonanza, right? Complete with dialect for the Chinese cook. It was as bad as the short story. The idea was great. I later sold the idea as a Virginian, but the execution left a lot to be desired. So I'm still reading my books, and my books say, not only is it critical to write for mediums you're familiar with, but write about a topic you're familiar with. And I thought, oh, Christ, crime. Well, what the hell am I doing writing about the Old West?
Well, I don't remember the Old West.
So I sit down, I watch all the crime shows on TV, I zero in on Ironsides, I say, yeah, great, he's thinking. I figure, well, what haven't I seen on TV? I thought, I've never seen a story about a righteous paper hanger, somebody that captures tens of thousands of dollars worth of payroll checks. And I had some experience in how to do it and how to get caught at it. So I knew I had a beginning, middle, and an end for the story. Which is also very important. So I sit down, I begin to write this story for Ironsides. Now, I knew how to type because I took typing in high school. Got up. I want you to see how everything comes together. All right? I graduated from this junior high school, and I lived on the borderline of the neighborhood, so only six of us were going to the high school I went to, which was racially mixed and angry, and I fit in perfect. I belong there, right? But because there was only six of us, when they take you around to show you your new high school, they usually take the girls and the boys and separate them and take them to those classes that are of interest to them. Well, there was only six of us, so they took the guys and the girls together. So the girls had to go through metal shop, auto shop, and all that crap. We had to go through home ec, you know, sewing and all that. And we walked into the typing class, right, with the girls, because they were showing the girls the typing class. And I looked at this typing class, and 30 of the best-looking girls on the campus were in the typing class, and not one guy, right? I said,
I'm going to take typing, man.
I took typing. I didn't care what anybody thought. I was in the room with the girls. You know, they could, you know, just... So now, it comes 30 years later, and I know how to type. God always knew, anyway. So I'm writing away, and I'm come home one night. I still don't have a car, still living in the same apartment, still walking everywhere I go. But I come home from a meeting with a friend of mine. I never knew what friends of mine did. I never asked. I never wanted to know because I just couldn't deal with that. I would relate to what they did instead of who they were. So I just decided I never want to know what people do. So this guy's dropping me off, and he says, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm trying to write a story for television. I want you to listen to all the scheming, maneuvering, manipulating, energy, and thinking I had to go through to follow this path that God put me on. I said, I'm writing a story to television. He said, oh, really? That's what I do. I said, what? He said, I write for TV. I said, yeah? He said, yeah. He said, when you're done with it, let me read it. Maybe I can help you out. I said, oh, yeah? Great. So I finished the story, and I give it to him. See how hard I had to look for him? Right? I just kept turning left, guys. I just kept turning left, okay? So, I finish the story. I give it to him. He makes 12 suggested changes. I hate six of them, so I only make the six I like. Okay, discovered later, it's fine, that's creative choice, my freedom. I get done with it, he says, listen, there's a girl on the program who, when she gets home from work, she types my stuff for me. Would you like her to type this up for you? I said, yeah, you know, somebody's going to have to. I'm sure Universal doesn't know that dead is spelled D-E-D. So I says, okay, great, well, we'll give it to her, right? So we give it to her. We get it off this girl, and I'm waiting. I think, oh, God,
that story. How am I going to get to the studio? What am I going to do? It'll be okay. Keep turning left. It's going to be fine. God will take care of all of it. It's all going to be okay. The story will get to the studio. The girl calls me up.
And 3 days later, says, listen, I just finished typing the story you wrote, and it's very good. She said, I read it, and I really like it. It's very good. She said, did Jim tell you where I work? I said, well, no, he didn't. Why? She said, well, I work for the associate producer on Ironside. Would you like me to take it in for you? Okay. See how far I had to look for her? How difficult it was to find her, to get it in. There is no pushing, shoving, maneuvering. It is a flow. There is a flow to the spiritual life. There really is a flow. Okay, to make a long story short, they bought it. I wrote the script. They put me under contract. A lot of good things. And I began to write. And I began to make a lot of money as a writer. Began to have a lot of success as a writer. And in television. Interesting things were going on. I never felt good. You know? I always drove into the studio in the morning knowing that this was the day that they were going to find me out. I didn't know what they were going to find out, but I knew that they were going to find it. And when they found it, it would be over for me. I knew that it would be over, that I wouldn't be a writer anymore. I'd come into the studio expecting my parking place to be gone, knowing that I had been fired, right? And I lived in terror, so I'm having this success and I'm living in terror. And I'm making a lot of money, but I don't know that I deserve a lot of money. I don't know that a lot of money is okay. I don't know that financial success is all right, because I don't have that much example around me that financial success is all right. So I picked a long line of women who like to spend money. No, I picked well. I know, no animosity. Hey, I picked them for what they did, and they did it. What the hell can I say, you know? That's when you just look at your own backyard. Did I really do that? But I did that. But every time I would leave the studio, after a year's worth of work, after killing myself for a year, making an enormous amount of money, I was always broke. Penniless. Penniless. Had nothing to show for it. No investment, nothing to show for it. That went on for 12 years. 12 years. 17 years clean and sober. I feel like a hamster. You know, I like a hamster. I'm in this little wheel going, you know, nothing's changing. Nothing's changing. Hey, guru, 17 years sober, respected speaker, babies all over the goddamn planet, you know. Penthouse apartment at the beach, Cadillac in the garage. Nothing inside feels good. I don't feel good. I don't know that I don't feel good, because I'm so out of touch with my feelings. I'm sitting in AA meetings, 17 years sober, sitting in AA meetings, listening to people talk about, my boss said this not to me this morning, and it hurt my feelings, and I didn't know what they meant. I did, honest to God, not know what they meant when they said their feelings had been hurt. I didn't know. I didn't know. I was so out of it, man, I didn't know. A friend looked at me and said, why don't you consider therapy? Well, I had always been very open-minded to therapy. Anyone I sponsored went into therapy, I fired them immediately. I said, obviously, whatever I have to offer and tools for recovery aren't sufficient for you, so screw you. Go find somebody else and lots of luck with the therapy, you know, if you don't drink. I knew one I wanted to see because I knew a girl who had seen this woman and I had watched changes. I had watched miracles take place in her life. See, I think therapy is just another spiritual tool. It gets the stuff out of the way so we can get to the receiving set in here, which is the child. Anyhow, I go to sit down with this woman. She, in our inductory meeting, and I may have just made up my own word. I do that a lot. I found out it's okay. You know, it's neat. That makes it even better. It's okay to do that. You can make up your own word. It's quite all right. It's acceptable. You just put your name in front of it and call it an Earlism. So anyhow, that kid wants to have fun now. Anyhow, I'm sitting with this woman. She says, tell me a little bit about yourself. Start with your childhood. Tell me a little bit about yourself. I said, okay. At 15 years of age, I discovered the marvelous world of drugs and alcohol. I was thrown out of high school. I spent the next 11 years running a lot of narcotics and drugs from Mexico to California in the streets with guns and weapons. I came to AA
17 years ago, and I've been clean and sober ever since. And she said, wait a minute. She said, tell me about your life starting with your childhood. You were not born at 15 years of age. I said, I don't remember anything back past 15. It's just kind of blank. You get that look, you know, they have a look they get. Probably like a gold miner when he knows there's gold in the mine, you know. Probably the kind they pray for, I don't know. Anyhow, she said, well, maybe we should go back and find out what's there. So we began a long, long process to go back and find out what's there. So what we found, to make it short, let's see, what did we find? Trying to think of a way to make it brief. Found an awful lot of pain and an awful lot of suffering. We found a little boy raised in a house with an alcoholic father and the typical neurotic woman. Now remember, I am an alcoholic father. I understand the reverse side of this, okay? But I can't do anything about the reverse side of this until I do something about the initial side of it. There is no hope, recovery, or any change I can offer to my children until I do something about what was done to my child, my own child. It's impossible until I correct this. The first relationship I must have is with me. Once I've learned that one, then I can have one with you. And I went back, and I found this little guy back there who, I have his picture on the TV set today. I keep it on the TV set. He's about, I got a picture of him before the damage began. He's about 14 months old, somewhere between 14 and 18 months old. He's in a little blue sailor suit. He's got blonde curly hair. He's got big blue eyes. He's got the dumbest expression you've ever seen on his face. Happy as a lark. Happy as a lark. Undamaged. You know, they say, and I believe this, you are born with two fears. Two fears are inherent upon birth. The fear of loud noises and the fear of falling. Now, if you're afraid of anything else as you sit here, you learned it. It is not natural, it is not normal, and you shouldn't have it. Okay? And guess where you got it? The original dynamic duo. Anyhow, I found out why I couldn't remember back. I discovered things like this little boy standing in the hallway at 2 years of age. He's got tears streaming down his face. And the reason he's got tears streaming down his face is because he had very high arches as a child, and he required special shoes to support these high arches. And it's because I had an alcoholic father who spent a lot of money on alcohol. Money was, although he had a good job, money was scarce in my house, you see. And I'm crying and I'm talking to my mother because my feet hurt. And the reason my feet hurt are the shoes are too small. They're too small. And I'm telling my mother they hurt. My mother's telling me, quiet. Your father might hear you and get mad. So today I have what's practically a club foot, a foot that rolls over and lays on one side. Geez, I wonder why I don't have a lot of self-esteem. I wonder why I don't think I'm worth anything. God damn it, if I'm not worth buying shoes for that fit by the two most important people in my life, how the hell am I supposed to face life? I mean, one of the things that was driving me nuts in sobriety was I was tired of goddamn going to dinner with people I didn't like and picking up the chicken, eating shit I didn't order, and, you know, eating cold food and going to movies I didn't want to see because somebody else, you know, had enough self-esteem to know what they wanted to see, you know. I was tired. One time I wrote a script for Starsky and Hutch, and I, in 4 days, jumped on an airplane, went to Hawaii, turned the script in. 3 days later, I'm in Hawaii, and a letter shows up in the mailbox where I'm staying, and I'm thinking, oh, from the producers of the show, I thought, oh, God. I'm standing there in the driveway with my friend, and I'm holding this envelope, reading through the envelope like any good alcoholic. And I know this letter says, you have just turned. This is what I know. This is what I feel. By this point, I'm probably 16 and a half years sober, and 16 years sober, and this is tragic. It is tragic that someone 16 years clean and sober has to stand in a goddamn driveway in Hawaii with an envelope in his hand. He can't open the envelope, and the only thing he knows that the envelope says
is not only you wrote the worst script we have ever read in our lives, and not only will you never work for our show again, you will never work for the studio again if we have anything to say about it. That's what I believe. That's what I believed in my heart.
And the girl said, why don't you open the envelope? Can't stand people who just keep moving and turn left at wall. I opened the envelope and the letter said, we are finished reading the first draft of your story and we wanted to take time to tell you it's got to be one of the two finest scripts that have ever been written for this show. We had intended to rush it to production, but we will now wait until you return to make the minor changes we need so that we can take the time with the show that it deserves. Thanks, the producers. You know what I said? I said, geez, at least they aren't pissed off. That's goddamn tragic. That is tragic. That is so sad, it's unbelievable, that I couldn't jump up in the driveway with this letter. Because this is something I've done. This is something I wrote. I sat in a little room alone by myself, and this came out of me. And all I can do is be grateful they aren't mad at me? Where the hell do you think I got that? Figure it out. The original dynamic duo. I spent my whole life trying to make sure they weren't mad at me. If they weren't mad at me, that was enough. That ain't enough. I should have been able to jump up in the driveway and wave this letter and go, yeah! Look at here! You know, called 17 people and said, they think I'm terrific. That's what I should have been able to do. But I couldn't do it. I absolutely couldn't do it. I put the letter away and went on about my business. I think I could sum it up best. See, yeah, right, okay, I agree. Absolutely. My mother and father did the very best job they could do with the tools they had and the information they had. They did the very best job they could do. That's only half of it, guys. That's only half of it. All right? And if you only focus on that half and you are the adult child of an alcoholic family, you're in a lot of trouble. Because the other half of it is this. They did a rotten goddamn job. It's in most instances criminally punishable. Punishable by imprisonment. That's the truth. And we sit around and deny that. Because if we look at that, we got to look at ours. I mean, it's a two-edged sword. But I had to finally look at them because I couldn't get free. I could not get free. 17 years sober, I'm still bogged down in no self-esteem and no feeling. It's best summed up. I know a girl who was celebrating. This is the best I've ever heard it put. A girl I know in AA was celebrating her first birthday. Her mother had 4 years of sobriety on the program. On her birthday, her mother called her and said this to her. Listen to this. Please listen to this. Her mother said, on this birthday, the only gift I can give you is this. I want you to understand that I know that I am responsible for most of the problems you have in your life today. I am responsible. But for your sake, please understand. You are responsible for the solutions to the problems. That's what the truth is. That's the truth. And that's the truth we run from. And that's the truth we hide from. And that's the reason we don't have enough goddamn self-esteem to take care of ourselves. We don't. Why does anybody smoke? The facts are in, guys. A pregnant woman who smokes should be put in jail for child abuse. The facts are in. Do you really want to smoke? Do you really enjoy smoking? Or is there a little voice in you every now and then that says, why don't we quit? Why don't we quit? Why don't we change our diet? Why don't we exercise? Why don't we do these things? And we don't do it. You know why? Because I never thought I was worth taking care of. In order to quit smoking, I gotta go through some discomfort. And I don't know that I deserve going through discomfort for. I think if I'm going through discomfort, something's wrong. I think feeling nothing is peace of mind.
The thing I discovered in the therapy process and the adult child process, and they'll tell you in adult children, all we're going to learn how to do is be a parent for a little child that lives inside of you. And you know, Anne told the story about sitting on the bathroom floor with the young girl, and I don't know how most of you probably heard it, and hugging her and crying for the first time in her sobriety. See, I don't think that's one alcoholic talking to another. I honest to God don't. I really don't. There was two little girls sitting on that bathroom floor. Two children. This little child that lives inside. And they were crying because they understand each other. Because their pain is the same. The children cried. The children cried. We have a child that we must take care of. And that child lives in here. I'm convinced of that. Absolutely, totally convinced. You could put me in front of the firing squad and say, do you believe it enough to die for it? And I'd say, yeah, pull the goddamn trigger. I believe it. There is a child. And I discovered this little happy, blue-eyed, blonde-haired little boy inside of me, and I had to start taking care of this kid, right? First thing I learned is he liked teddy bears. Loves bears. I have a house full of bears now. Right? There's Steve Bears on the tie. You know, there's a little bear on my lapel. A lady gave me here a beautiful little bear. There's three in the room. Bears always travel with me. There's three teddy bears in the room. One was mine when I was a child. We just brought him into the family. We just discovered. I didn't know my mother had him. She's had him for 43 years, 45 years, 46 years. A long time she's had the bear. Anyhow, he's joined the bear family now. He's very happy because he's a very old bear and he's been very, very alone for a long time, stuck with the original dynamic duo, which is true. He's in a very happy household of a lot of bears. I had to learn to nurture this child. I want you to know it's okay to risk looking silly. The Olympics were this time around were the single most emotionally draining thing I have been through in a long time. Because my child wanted to watch the Olympics. And I would have the set on and he would sit there looking at the Olympics and he would see some boy and he would hear about this boy's family who had ridden all the way from Minnesota to California on a motorcycle to watch their child participate in this event because they loved them so goddamn much and they wanted to be there and be supported. And my child cried and died because nobody ever even fucking showed up for Parents' Day at school. See? And he just sobbed and bawled because he hurt so bad. And then the kid would go ahead and he'd win his event. And my child would cry tears of joy because he succeeded. Right here about the kid whose dad worked 4 hours of overtime a night for 2 years. 2 years so he could participate. Because he believed in him. Because he taught him he was important. That he counted for something. That he mattered. That it wasn't what he wore. It wasn't what he said. It wasn't what he did. That he was just important because he was there. See, we're important just because we're here, but we don't know that because we weren't raised, goddammit, to believe that. And my child cried. But the other side of it is, my child also knew that all the teddy bears wanted to watch the Olympics, right? So, if I had gone out to a meeting somewhere to be with friends, if my managers in the building where I live had come into my apartment while I was gone, they would have found about 20 bears on the love seat and the sofa in the living room with the TV on. And another 15 in the bedroom on a bed in an arch with that TV on, right? They were enjoying the Olympics. They were having a good time. I must let my child be a child. I must let him be a child. And also in this, I heard Bob talk about immaturity. Well, of course, there's an adolescent that lives in here, too. You know, I discovered the adolescent was the biggest pain in the ass I ever met in my life.
The adolescent's the one that falls in love with a lake.
Oh, wow, look at her. That's it. I know, it's her. I'm in love. I used to run laps at a high school, okay? Some mornings I was in a great place, and I could see these young girls in this high school where I ran as young women beginning about to blossom into womanhood and to go on into life, and their children, and I would have a great day. Other days I saw them as potential dates, you know.
Hey, look at her, right?
Well, on those days I wanted to die. I'd say to myself, oh, you are so sick. God, you're one of these dirty old guys that's going to be cruising high school. What are you going to do now? Who the hell in AA are you going to tell about this? Yeah. And the adolescent would get nuts. One time I was running down San Vicente, it's a street I run on, tree lined with glass in the middle. And during the summer last year, apparently they let out, not this year, but the year before, they must have let out the UCLA girls volleyball team or somebody to run out there. But anyhow, there was an abundance of absolutely gorgeous girls over 6 feet tall, about 18 years of age. I'm running down the street and coming up this way is this brunette who's about 6 feet, just oh, magnificent. And my adolescent sees her, or I covet it, he's getting, you know, first he's got to get the stride looking better, you know. Because this is a 48-year-old cripple who's running out there, you know. Which he can't stand that, right? So he gets it looking as good as he can. And he looks at her, and I'm trying to hold him down like be cool as a child. You know, it's just she's a little girl, she's 18, and he's like crazy, and I've got all this energy going on. We went by, she smiled. She must have picked up the energy, right? Well, I wish she hadn't smiled, because he went nuts, see? He said, oh, it's her, goddammit, it's her. It's the one we've looked for all these years. We got to talk to her. Turn around. Catch her. I said, I don't think we can catch her. She was about 6 feet tall, had about 8 foot stride, was running about 6 minute miles, you know. He said, don't be chicken shit, not now, not now. It's too late, go for it. I said, hey, look, you gotta understand something. If we catch her, you're not probably gonna be able to talk to her because I'm going to have developed a serious breathing problem. He says, go for it, man, go for it. Now is the time, do it. So I turned around, did my best Alberto Salazar for about 3/4 of a mile. At the end of 3/4 of a mile, I'm wrapped around a banyan tree in the middle of the divider, about ready to throw up because I've stressed myself to my aerobic maximum. I'm on this tree. The only recourse left is to vomit. And I say to the adolescent, see? I told you. Yeah. And he shut up. He's been better ever since that experience. His problem was he had a lot of difficulty accepting the fact that he was in a 48-year-old body. That was his biggest trouble. The other thing that's happened is I met and fallen in love with somebody who has an adolescent in her, and they're compatible. You know, she has a great stereo in her car. He loves it. You know, I mean, stuff like that. It is. That helps. And he came to me one day, the adolescent, and I was getting rid of a 4-door sedan, and he said, get a Corvette. And I said to him, I don't want a Corvette. He said, oh, you got to get a Corvette. I said, no, man, I look silly in a Corvette. He said, oh, no, no. You got to get a Corvette. They're low and sleek and beautiful. They look incredible. I said, you got to have a Corvette. And I thought for a minute, I thought, all right, you know, you never had a car you didn't steal or steal the money for. I'll get you the Corvette. So I got Corvette. Now we had a problem with the child and the adolescent. Children are like dogs in cars, you know? I mean, they like to just hang out the window. Right, you know. Looking cool is not in their book, you know? They want to live, they have no desire to look cool. And a Corvette has T-roofs on it, right? The kid always wanted the T-roofs off. You know, look around, see? And the windows down. T-roofs off, windows down on the freeway. That's what the kid wants. Well, the adolescent has a problem with that because it messes his hair. See? And it's very important to you to look good at all costs, right? So what I finally had to do with arbitrations, whenever we go on a long trip on the freeways, I'd have to take along, I went out and bought a spray bottle of water and got a hairbrush so we could take the T-roof off and put the windows down for the child, and we could fix the adolescent's hair when we got him there, right? All being a parent to the kids, right? Well, anyhow, the adolescent had a lead foot, and when I finally got the letter from the DMV saying one more ticket, I think I was nailed by the highway patrol at 100 on Highway 5, and I had been talking to the adolescent. I'd been saying, you must learn to drive reasonably or you're in trouble. And he couldn't contain himself. He'd get in the car, and it was low, and he'd look out over the hood, and that's it. He was gone, you know. So I had been a very loving parent. He asked me for something, I gave it to him, he bucked up, I took it away. The third person I met in this process, and by the way, I haven't had a speeding ticket since I took it away. Third person I met in this process is the adult. The adult is incredible. I met a 48-year-old adult male, and the thing about him that is absolutely marvelous to me is the fact that I like him. I'm meeting a man in myself that I would like if I met in a room someplace else. And that's incredible. I walk by mirrors now, I no longer have to look away. I can smile and wink at myself and give a little pop. And I never could do that. And people in AA used to say in the beginning, right, the standard thing, go home, look in the mirror, tell yourself that you love you. Say, I love you. You're dealing with a destroyed human being, right, that goes home and looks in the mirror. I think you are the sickest son of a bitch I've ever seen in my life. And you turn around and walk away from the mirror, because, you know, you don't know how to love yourself. You don't know how to take care of yourself. You don't know how to nurture this child. Well, the adult is a beautiful person. And the fourth person now that exists, the fourth voice, of course, is the mind. It's still there. It still talks the same trivial bullshit. And I just spend most of my time not listening. I just go about my day anyway. Even though it's the end of the world, I have cancer, I'm dying, I'm too tired, and my career is over, I just kind of go about my day anyway. And it's lost an awful lot of its power. Just today, like, I don't do a lot of things today. Like, I don't eat meat, I don't smoke, I don't eat sugar, I don't drink coffee, I don't, a lot of those things. So I believe in exercise. I believe that if the program of AA was founded today instead of almost 50 years ago, the same men who founded it were so far ahead of their time then. If they founded AA today, therapy, exercise, and nutrition would be an integral part of the program. Absolutely. Bill understood the value of therapy. He was in it when he was 4 years sober, and that was in 1937. It wasn't terribly popular then, you know. They had a psychiatrist and two ministers as guest speakers at the 20th anniversary of AA because they were important to AA and to the people in AA. I'd like to see you try and get a shrink into the 50s. They'd go nuts. We become more closed-minded instead of more open-minded, and that's kind of tragic because we got to become open-minded. Meet this, right, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's only out of fear. It's only out of fear. If you meet this child, if you get to meet this child, AA, if everybody knew was in touch with their children in AA, this would be the most fun place in the world to be. Be like goddamn kindergarten. It would be wonderful. Wonderful. And everybody would be happy for everybody else because nobody would believe that you got... I know that when you get success, I want you to have it because it ain't mine you got. You got yours. And I want to help you get yours. Because if I can help you get yours, people are going to help me get mine. But if I sit tied up and resent yours, I'm just in so much trouble. The standard line we use, I'll tell the story and get it quick. The standard line most people use, and I use it, you'll be 20 years old and you can use this line, and it's really sad. It is, well, yeah, but geez, I'm worried. It's too late. It's just too late, you know? I mean, who cares now? There's a speaker who tells us one story. I love it because it's classic. It's the classic no self-esteem thinking. He went to his sponsor. He's talking to his sponsor. He said,
So I said, what the hell do you want to do? He says, well, I really like to be a lawyer. I've been giving a lot of thought to being a lawyer. I'd really like to be a lawyer. But by the time I graduate from law school, I'll be 44 years old. Standard, no self-esteem thinking. His sponsor looked at him and smiled and said, how old will you be then if you don't graduate? You see, we're great at talking ourselves out of stuff. I mean, people say the newcomer is the most important person in AA. If you view my opinion, if you view AA as a furnace that needs coals to keep it going, then I guess that's an apt opinion. All right? But I've come to understand something here. Listen, the most important person in this room sits in your chair. Nobody in this room is more important than you. Nobody. Because if you can't take care of yourself, if you can't love yourself, if you can't communicate with yourself, if you can't be intimate with you, you can't do or be these things with anything else. You want to know what your next relationship's going to be like? Look at how the person you're involved with treats themselves. Because they can't do it any better for you than they do it for them. And if they can't take care of themselves in an emotional crisis, they can't take care of you. And if they can't express their feelings, they can't let you express your feelings. It's getting in touch with these feelings and coming alive. I had a girl come up to me in the meeting not long ago. She's 9 years sober, riding with her fiancé down the street. And suddenly something got her really angry about something in her past, and she cried and got mad and pounded on the dashboard because she was so goddamn angry. Well, she was getting the anger out in a constructive way, not hurting anybody, not bothering anybody, getting the feelings out. And he looked at her and he said, I'm shocked. I expect much more control from you than that.
I said to her, she asked me what I thought. So I think you ought to dump them, is what I think.
Do what you want. But it's our society. It's not just us. One thing, and then I'll tell the story. There was a kid in the Olympics. I don't know. Most of you watching the Olympics. There was a kid who wanted to break the world record in one event. I don't know, backstroke, butterfly, whatever. His whole goddamn, he missed the Olympics before. And his whole goal was to break the world's record. Which, by God, is very admirable. That's a lot of courage. That's a lot of self-esteem. To say, my goal is to break, what I want to do is be the best in the world. Not the best in the state or the country. I want to be the best in the world. And he won the event. And he won the gold medal. But he didn't break the world record. And he was goddamn disappointed. And it showed on his face in the pool. He wasn't happy. He wasn't thrilled. He wasn't jumping up doing the big yahoo everybody else was doing. Because he had set a higher goal for himself. And the press gave that poor kid such a bad goddamn time, he had to apologize. He had to apologize publicly for expressing his feelings. That's wrong. The kid was right. The kid was right. The kid took the risk. The kid said, this is what I want. And I'm going to give it my all. And he didn't make it. He said, well, goddammit, I'm disappointed. Hey, that's healthy. That's healthy.
Don't ever say to yourself it's too late, because I want to tell you a story about a little man. I was watching television one morning before an event was about to take place. And they were talking to this guy. And this guy was telling the interviewer that when he was 65 years old, he was living with his son. And he was a guy who smoked cigarettes and ate crap and thought negatively and wasn't doing much. His son came into him one morning and said, Dad, I'm going to put you in a home. And the guy said to his son, he said, no, don't do that. He said, please don't do that. I don't want to go in a home. Anything but a home. And his son said, well,
then do something. Do anything.
You're just sitting here dying. Do something. Come running with me in the morning, but do something.
So the old man said, I will do anything, anything, not to be put at home. So I got up the next morning and went running with his son. And the old man was able to go a fourth of a block, and he couldn't breathe. Couldn't breathe. His legs wouldn't go one more foot. His lungs wouldn't go one more foot. And his kids said, never mind, Dad, forget it. We'll talk about it later. I don't know what we're going to do. The old man said, screw it. He got up the next morning and he went out and ran another quarter of a block. And he got up the next morning and went out and ran another quarter of a block. And in the 3 months, he finally made a mile. And when he made that mile, he suddenly realized that if he was in this horrible condition